You're listening to Radio DMG.
And welcome back to Radio DMG. I'm your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth. And for today's episode, we're going to dive all the way back to 2014 for, we didn't do a Kickstarter panel. We recorded a Kickstarter panel audio stuff at Mile High Con 2014. Yeah, let's go ahead and get that out of the way. Kind of embarrassing. I don't remember if we didn't put this out. But now we're going to. So sit back, throw your headphones on, relax, and allow me, your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, who goes to way too many conventions, to cue the music.
John Fiala. As you can see, I lost my name mere moments after entering the building, and as such, I do not have a cute little standee in front of me, but that's not really as important. This is the Kickstarter and Beyond Successful Crowdsourcing. Pause for people to leave if there was a panel they wanted to go to. I myself am the moderator. I'm John Fiala, but I have not actually created any Kickstarters. I have instead backed a surprising number of them, which my wife would wish I would lay off a little bit on, but you know, just they're so shiny. And and what we have with us today are four people who I will allow themselves to introduce themselves and their work, who have done a Kickstarter, or in one case, is about to do a Kickstarter. And I will allow them to talk. Why don't you go first, and then just continue down the line here.
Okay. My name is Travis Heerman, and I'm a local writer, and I've got four novels out right now. One of them I indie-pubbed via a Kickstarter, and that project was really successful, and I'm delighted with how it turned out. And I've also done another Kickstarter. I tried to kickstart an anthology last year about this time, and that did not go. And so I learned a lot from both experiences. And come talk to me afterward. I have some free flash, just so come up and grab a piece.
Cool.
I'm Courtney Schaefer, and I'm the person
who's
about to be doing a Kickstarter. I'm going to do it in February, and the reason I am is because I write adventure fantasy, and my publisher of these first two novels of my series is Nightshade Books, which nearly went bankrupt last year, and they did get bought out, but my agent and I did not feel entirely confident with the new buyers, and so on my agent's recommendation, actually, I decided to do a Kickstarter for the third novel of the trilogy. Several of my author friends have done very successful Kickstarters, and so I've been studying up and learning all the tips and tricks, and I'll be very interested to hear everybody else's experiences.
I'm Susan Price. I am the titular president, but really one-third of Diamond Dust Dreams, which is a new game company. We have one game in print, Kitsune of Foxes and Fools, which we successfully Kickstarted last summer. We have another game in development called Newsflash Bad Decisions, which we were going to kickstart in August, and that's when the printed copies of our first game came in, and so we had to be fulfilling our Kickstarter backers, blah, blah, blah. So we actually shut down the Kickstarter after 2 weeks and are relaunching in January.
I'm Jay Irvine. I'm a writer, editor, publisher, game designer. I may be on this panel to tell you how not to do this, as I run three Kickstarters, one for each of these books, and was successful with Martian Wave, and was not successful with the other two. So I may be telling you how not to do it.
So, what's a good question here? Sorry, I had notes and naturally left them in the car, as will happen. So, what led you to use Kickstarter? I guess I'll start with asking everybody that.
Well, it was somewhat of a long process for me. I have, for a long time, had a very strong negative stigma against self-publishing, largely because I believe most of it out there is not rated for big, for prime time. And so I really wasn't quite sure that I wanted, that I didn't want to go that way. But I had a trilogy, and somewhat like Courtney, the publisher, that publisher, Five Star, discontinued their fantasy and science fiction line after the first book came out. So that kind of orphaned that series. Meanwhile, I had written a second book, and it just kind of sat there on my hard drive, not really doing anything for a couple of years. And then I started to hear about Kickstarter, and I'm like, well, let's try it. So over the course of about, sort of from that moment of epiphany up until I launched that project was about 4 months. And I was just, and during that time, it was kind of a series of events where I encountered the editor who had bought the first novel at WorldCon. And I'm like, well, I've got this other novel, and I don't know, would you be willing to edit it for me? And he's like, oh yeah, I love that book, let's do it. So. All right, well, okay, where am I going to get, you know, $1,200? So I was able to, I was able to work with the original editor again, so he knew the material. I was able to hire the same cover illustrator who I'd worked with on the previous book, and I'm like, well, let's go, let's see what happens. And that's what led me to it, and it worked first time out.
Awesome.
Yeah, you've already heard a little bit of my spiel, but I'll say that one reason I chose to do Kickstarter rather than simply self-publishing the third book directly without doing Kickstarter first was because, sort of like Travis, I wanted to match the quality of the first two novels, and so actually I'm hiring almost all the same people that worked on the first two books, so the joke is it's still Nightshade that's publishing, it's just everyone's getting paid this time. So, but yeah, I had the same cover artist. I actually went ahead and hired the cover artist and cover designer up front so that I would have the cover ready to show people and everything. That kind of helps people see that it's a real book, it's really there. But as to why I chose Kickstarter as opposed to Indiegogo or, you know, some of the other options that are out there, the author friends of mine that have done crowdsourced projects in the past said that the strength of Kickstarter is that the user interface, essentially, for both you and for the people that back your project, they have developed a lot of ways for you to easily send updates, for people to share it on social media, all these kinds of things, and afterwards, fulfilling back rewards, they have ways for you to take surveys and this, and so it's a lot more user-friendly in that way. If you're doing a smaller project, like less than $1,000, people say Indiegogo is a good choice. For that, you don't need to fund the project all the way. You to get the money that you're going to get, however much people give you, that's how much you get. But they're not as user-friendly as Kickstarter, and they also lack that kind of, what's the right way, or cachet of respectability. Kickstarter does vet their projects, and so within, to some extent, but within the author community, there's the sense that if you're doing Kickstarter, you're serious about what you're doing, and so that's why I chose that option.
I would say much the same things going off of what you said. We actually chose Kickstarter not to fully fund our game because Kickstarter, what we got from Kickstarter, which was about $6,000, $5,000 gold, which is good. But we knew that wasn't going to be enough for us to print the game. What we wanted was proof of concept. Were there enough people out there that were willing to spend around $50 or even more than that to get premiums on it for a game that had hitherto existed only in my son James' head? And the answer was yes. There were 80-some people out there that were willing to slap down big bucks. Half of our backers were backing us at the 75 or higher level. And so we said, okay, we've got something. We know it's going to be a niche game. But the people who like it love it. So we went ahead and sank the other I don't even want to do the math. It's probably $40,000 or $50,000 that we've sunk on this game so far. But on our next game, we are actually going to have a Kickstarter goal that it's at least twice as much and maybe four times as much, because to get the price point, we want to sell the second game, which is a party game. We want to be able to match the price range of Apples to Apples and Cards Against Humanity, which is right around $25. To do that, we have to print 10,000 copies. To do that, it's going to cost us $40,000, of which we have to pay half up front. So, which one of the things I would say about Kickstarter versus Indiegogo, not only is it a much more user-friendly interface, not only do they have all these wonderful apps associated with it, but they force you to hit your goal before you get any payout. You can maybe weasel away with it, like she said, on Indiegogo if you've got a $1,000 or less project. But if you don't make all your money on a $10,000 project, how are you going to fulfill your rewards to your starters if you can't make the thing that you needed that money to make? So we've found that Kickstarter keeps us honest.
The way I came to Kickstarter, I had been editing The Martian Wave for over a decade. Started out with ProMart, Riot Labs, which it was an e-zine. ProMart was taken over by Sam's Dot. We kept it as an e-zine, and then it turned into a print magazine. And I continued to edit it, and when Sam's Dot was taken over by White Cat Publications, I reluctantly went along with the understanding that if I wasn't happy there, The Martian Wave would be mine to take with me. And so I left White Cat for reasons we don't need to go into, and decided to publish it under Nomadic Delirium Press, which was a small press publisher that I was using to publish games and such. And the simple fact was, we have three kids, we both work, we didn't have the money really to get the magazine going right away, and so I decided to run Kickstarter so that we could get the magazine out, because we already had all the stories, we were ready to go, we just needed the funds to get it going. And so I went with Kickstarter and managed to successfully fund it.
I think you touched on a really important point there too. As did you, when you start a crowdfunding project, you need to have something to show people. A really important part of the project is the video. The video needs to have product to show. In your case, it will be a beautiful cover that you already had made. In your case, you have previous copies and you can hold up manuscripts and say, we've got all the stories we need, whatever.
And we already had the cover art too.
Right.
So
again, you have something that you can show, look, it's going to be a real thing. In our case, we've had playable prototypes of the games that we can actually show how it's played in the video. And so people know that it's really going to happen. It's not just vaporware somewhere. It is a thing. There are printed cards, there are printed covers, there are whatever. So they're more likely to not only be interested, but be willing to let Kickstarter put a lien on their credit card for however much is going to be taken out when the project closes.
Yeah, I think one thing that's common to whatever project you're doing, book, you know, game, anything like that, is that most of the work of the Kickstarter is going to be done beforehand on your part. You have to build up, you have to not only get ready the idea that you're going to sell for your project, you're going to have to make that video, you're going to have to set up all your rewards and everything, but you really also need to start networking through the people that you're trying to reach. Because if you wait to do that until the Kickstarter starts, that is kind of too late.
It's at least three months too late.
You need to do the work in advance, and you really need to start making contacts and get the project out there already so that people are excited about the Kickstarter when it starts.
My son did a lot of background research before we launched our first Kickstarter, and one of the things he found was one of the reasons we picked 5,000 was that for people who have never done a Kickstarter before, who don't have a platform already developed, you know, they're not with a game company that's already done five games, or they're not with a publisher who's already published a couple of dozen books or whatever, that 5,000 to 10,000 is doable, that up to 80% of the Kickstarters at that level that start off well succeed. Above 10,000, if you haven't done it before, 80% of them fail. And the other thing that he found was if you are going to fund, you have to have at least 10 to 20% in the first weekend, the first few days that you're live, and within the first week, you have to have 25%. Even if you're running for a month and a half rather than a month, at the end of the first week, if you want to be successful, you have to have 25% of your funding. If you don't hit that goal, you're going to have to really, really stretch to get the money to come in. You have to start strong. One of the reasons is because Kickstarter will actually promote you if you start strong. You will end up in their featured projects, featured new projects, hot projects. So anything you can do to keep your rate up early will really help you in the long run.
Part of what she's talking about is in Kickstarter, the strong start is that perceived success breeds success. Right? If it looks like your Kickstarter is going well, people, they respond to that and go, oh, okay, well, this must be a real deal, and are more likely to jump in.
In some ways, it's kind of amusing because the money doesn't get taken off of your credit card until the end of the period, but people budget in the now. And so the other thing we did was, as soon as we started our Kickstarter, we were already going to conventions, playing the game with them, and we would be talking to people about, so you can go on to Kickstarter now, and we'll give you this thing that reminds you with our address and everything. And they'd be like, yeah, I really want to do this. And we noticed that the pattern was would be Friday to Sunday at a convention, and the next Friday we would get the bump in pledges from the week before because they waited until they got their paycheck, even though it was going to be three paychecks later before it was taken out of their checking account. But the budgeting thing works that way. So there's all sorts of little quirks in how you're approaching people and what you need to expect.
Yeah, people have done some really interesting analysis on the best time of week to start your Kickstarter, because Kickstarter writes that 30 days, it ends exactly 30 days to the, you know, to the minute from when you start it. So you need to pick a time that it's going to end at a time that the people are at their computers, that people are excited, because the two big times when people pledge are at the very beginning and at the very end. You tend to have like kind of a slump in the middle.
Yeah, there's a long agonizing stretch.
It works a lot like the pledge campaigns for radio stations. Okay, so they'll be puttering along through the middle of it, and then at the end of it, they're like, we still need to make $25,000 this weekend, and then the next day it's like, well, we're doing great, we're down to $15,000, and then the last day it's like, we have $10,000 left. 4 hours later, we have 5,000 left, you know, 2 hours later, we can still make it. So you have this dynamic going. Mentioned about the way you can do updates. The updates get pushed out to people who have already Kickstarted with you, and they are posted on the site for anyone who's looking at it. The more you communicate, the more you let people know what's going on, that also generates interest. If you launch your Kickstarter and don't do any updates till the end of it, people are like, are they even interested? Are they even there? The other thing Kickstarter lets you do is that once you have set your goal, you can't change it once you go live. But you can set a lower goal to begin with, you know, as low as you can, and know that that will give you enough to do what you need to do. And then set stretch goals, which you don't even need to announce at the beginning. You can simply announce there will be stretch goals. And then as you like close in on your goal of 5,000, you can, in the updates, announce, oh, by the way, we have a stretch goal. If we hit 6,000, this extra thing kicks in on the base. I don't know, everyone who supports gets the artist signing as well as the author or whatever. And at, you know, 7,500, we're going to throw in a free e-short story for everybody, or whatever. You can you be creative, you do something that is related to the project. In our case, the stretch goals related to how much color we were putting on the cards in our standard edition. We got enough that we committed to not only full color on all the Fox cards, but shaded art rather than line art on all the Fool cards. So, and our upper level rewards in just the regular goal were you could pay extra to have a caricature of yourself or somebody you cosplay. We had a lot of fursuiters supporting us. So, you know, we have some interesting fantasy animals that will be showing up behind some of the art on our various cards because they paid for that placement, and they will be showing up in a special limited edition that will never be reprinted, but everybody who supported us has their art in all of it, so they're famous in a small way. And that was hugely popular. We're going to do something similar in our party game, which is we are going to allow people to help us write the cards, basically. It's like the blank card you get in Cards Against Humanity, only this will be your card that's added to the game with everyone else.
Cool. Neat. So, a lot of good ideas on things to do. I thought maybe I'd ask, what's something to definitely not do, or a definite mistake when doing a Kickstarter? And since you said you found one or two yourself, I figured we'd start with you and come this way.
I actually think she already hit on it. Update. I didn't do that enough with at least one of them. And because I started off fairly strong, hit the 20% in the first week, and I just didn't do enough updating, and everybody lost interest in it. By the end, I was too far behind. When I got that little bump at the end, it wasn't enough.
Yeah, I think never be complacent, but also never give up. Our second game, we had actually planned to start in August. We actually launched it in August. We hadn't done as much. We've been playing it for almost a month at a couple of different conventions. We had played very, very preliminary, and we actually played a first, what I call pre-alpha hand-cut prototype at Mile High Con last year. That was the first time we played it in public. We didn't get people committed to, when we say we're launching, you will support us right then to get us started. Well, that was our biggest failure on our second Kickstarter. So we shut it down after 2 weeks because we knew we wouldn't make goal, and rather than having a failed Kickstarter, we figured we'll just put it on hiatus and bring it back in January. But interestingly, the two and a half weeks we did run it, we actually learned a lot more about the story we needed to tell about the game. We needed to be positioning it a little better, and we also created a new reward level because we found a couple of game stores that had a history of backing Kickstarter games, and they wanted to be able to back us. Well, it used to be on Kickstarter you could have kind of like two different playing fields, and so you could have a retailers only supporting. You can't do that anymore. Kickstarter wants all of the levels to be available to anybody who wants to back you. So we came up with a, I forget what we called it, but it was basically 10 for 100, which is the price that we would be allowing retailers to buy it at once it's produced. So we figured, you know, if you want to commit to the 10 for 100 and have 9 games to give away to your friends next Christmas, fine, whatever, we don't care. We just want your money.
I guess for my author friends that have done successful Kickstarters, sometimes very successful Kickstarters, like Michael Sullivan's, I don't know how you say his series name, but he, I think he was asking for $4,000 or $5,000 and got $30,000 from his backers. He has a very huge fan base, though. He's one of the big self-publishing successes that then went on to get a traditional deal with Orbit. And this is a book that Orbit had turned down, and he put it out through Kickstarter. But I talked to him, and he said that the one thing that, you know, the stretch goals and stuff like that, really watch out that you are not overloading yourself with work, or that you're not getting carried away and offering people things that they don't even really want. Like in his case, his artist, I think it was Mark Simonetti, he said, oh, when we reach this amount of money, everybody gets a print of, you know, the cover or whatever. And he was like, that was the stupidest thing I ever did. Because, you know, I mean, so many people backed his project, so that meant he had to sign all those prints, ship them, and whatever. And half of the people didn't even really want them.
And, right? And the prints are expensive.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very easy to get carried away, I think, and, you know, especially if your Kickstarter is actually going well, to say, oh, when we hit this, I'm going to do this, and then.
Well, even at the lower levels, because we very carefully structured it so that until you were at the level of this is the amount that will get you a standard printed copy of the game, all of the rewards were electronic. You were getting art from the game, you were getting a poster from the game, you were getting advanced PDFs of the card faces so you could do a print and play if you wanted to, but none of it was costing us anything. All we had to do was push a button and send the address out to people, and then they had it.
That's right. Don't forget about shipping costs. Don't forget you're going to have to pay taxes on the money, and don't forget that Amazon takes 5% of your total.
I hear with Kickstarter you lose 10% just off the bat.
Yeah, 9 to 10.
Yeah.
Kickstarter gets 5%, and then the credit card companies take a cut also.
It depends on how much money, how big the percentage is. Yeah, we probably lost about 7 or 8% overhead. However, when we looked at the 85 people who backed us, the people that were not friends and family, and were not people that we knew we had played with at conventions, were people that came in through Kickstarter. And the people that came in through Kickstarter more than paid for the amount that we had to pay Kickstarter, so it was definitely worth it for us.
I'm sure it is, but it's something to keep in mind.
They hand
you a check for $6,000, they hand
you
a check for
$5,000. We made $6,251 on our Kickstarter, and we got $5,900 and changed. It was just
under $6,000. So we were talking about what not to do.
Yeah, what's the biggest mistake to do?
Fail to do your homework. What not to do is to put up a project that looks half-assed. That make sure that you have. Because one of the things that I did when I was, you know, learning about all this, was I looked at a bunch of projects that were like mine, which were novels, and I looked at ones were successful, some of them wildly so, some of them that failed, and I looked for commonalities in both camps, and it doesn't take long to start figuring some things out, right? Most of the ones that failed, they had, you know, amateurish artwork, or it was just clear that this person was a beginner, or there were like some glaring deficiencies in what they were trying to put together. So what you want to do is to present, I mean let's be honest, our friends and family are the people who are first and most likely to back what we're doing, right? But unless you have an enormous family and a big established fan base, you still need to reach out beyond your immediate social circles to people that don't know you. And to get those people to back you, you need to have a project that looks professional. Even if it's not quite done yet. For example, with that book, you know, I told who the editor was that I was going to hire, and what his credentials were, the cover artist and what his credentials were, and the graphic designer and what his credentials were. So I presented the fact that I had a team of pros that was working on this project, that was going to work on this project. And I think that went a long way. Because when you look at the ones that fail, some of it's lack of updates, but a lot of it is, it's just clear that this person doesn't know what they're doing. So your job then is to know what you're doing. And even if you don't exactly, fake it till you make it. And you'll learn a lot along the way.
Cool.
One of the big ways to do that is not only have somebody edit your book, but have somebody proofread your project before you go live. Yeah. Kickstarter allows you to let people in to preview the site. And like you said, you looked at other authors' sites. Having authors who are friends of yours look at yours before you go live. And my son, he happens to be part of a listserv email group for game designers, and he reached out to a half a dozen of them before we went live with ours and got fabulous feedback in terms of what we were doing wrong with the video. So we actually postponed our internally planned launch for 2 weeks so that we could re-edit the video. Any feedback that you can get before you go live that will make you look like you know what you're doing is a good thing.
Cool. Yeah, I'm a member of a Google Plus group called Kicksnarker, where, among other things, we will occasionally make fun of those projects whose reach exceeds their grasp, whether before the project funds, like, oh my God, do they really think somebody's going to give them money for this? Or afterwards, when it's been a year and instead of producing the whatever, the person in charge has decided to instead go after some lawyer for dressing like Arthur Dent. I am not making this up. seriously, it's a train wreck. It's crazy. So, but one of the things that we do on that group is people will pop by. Admittedly, the focus tends to be more on the board game and role-playing community, and say, hey, here's my Kickstarter. I'm going to launch in a week or so. Can you give me any feedback? And we're all perfectly happy to give constructive and gentler feedback to somebody who's certainly willing to look before they leave. So, yeah, check with your friends, check with your enemies, find out what perhaps you missed about something. So, one thing every Kickstarter has is usually a whole bunch of different backer levels. And I was wondering if people would like to go into how they decided on what backer levels to have, or if they decided on something they wouldn't do for a backer level, just as something to talk about. And again, why don't we start down there?
Free copies are always the easiest one to do. At the lower levels, I'll do free ebooks. Going up higher, free print copies. You can go as far as free print signed copies for some of the higher levels. For Torrent Tales, I did run that on Indiegogo as well. And so we did get some support from that. I did learn on that one that if you're going to do every contributor is going to sign it, make sure you set the goal much higher than I did, because now I have to nail the book around, and by the time everybody signs it, it's going to be too much. But mostly we do free copies. With Torrent Tales, we also had a level where, because we're going to do a Torrent Tales 2 in the future, where if you donate at this level, your character, your name will be adapted into Torrentese, and you'll have a character named after you in one of the stories coming out.
So that's that personalization I was talking
about.
It's very attractive.
Because everybody likes the free copies, but people also want more than that. It can be difficult to do. I mean, in a game, it's a lot easier, I think, than in a book that's already done. But
well, and I totally hear you on the whole signed copy thing. For the standard edition, we only had about 45 copies that were going up, but we said they would be signed by the game developer and the artist, which luckily they're brothers, Unluckily, one of them lives in Illinois, the other one lives in the Twin Cities. So they told everybody, things will be mailed in 2 weeks. We've got the games in now, they'll be mailed in 2 weeks. Why? Because in 2 weeks, Ian was going up to the Twin Cities for a convention, and he brought the extra 9 or 10 boxes of games so they could just spend an afternoon each of them signing the cover. And it takes a while.
I guess, you know, one good point about the reward thing actually is a good advice that I saw from this band, actually, the Double Clicks, they're called. They just finished a Kickstarter relatively recently where they asked for $18,000 and got $80,000. You know, but part of that, they had a really good system of reward levels and stretch goals set up, but they said make a spreadsheet and lay out what the cost of that reward are going to be and how many people, like, so that you can play with the numbers of it. This many people ask at this level, how much is that going to cost to produce that, whatever it is, and how much time, this kind of thing, and so that you can look at the math, because they said that that is a really good way to judge, kind of, like you were saying, is the shipping going to be too much, you know, for this? Is this going to put me into the red in the Kickstarter, this kind of thing? So, you know, for me, for books, for, you know, obviously I'll have the, you know, this much for an ebook, this much for a paperback, this much for copies, signed copies of the whole series. But then because I thought it would be fun, you know, this book involves mountaineering and I'm a mountaineer. So for some of the higher reward levels, you know, for $500 I'll take you up a mountain, you know, this kind of thing. It's stuff that it would be fun for me to do. You can make them limited at that level. You can say, I'll, you know, there's only three of these, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think it's kind of fun when authors and other people think a little bit out of the blue box, something that's sort of related to your series, but it's not going to cost you too much time and effort, but that might, people might think, oh, that's kind of fun.
So, how many people are you willing to take up on this? I mean, are you going to limit it to three?
Yeah.
Three.
All on the same trip, or?
No, they have to get themselves to Colorado. I'll take them up a 14er, choice of 14er based on their experience level, and you know. But there's 14ers that are easy enough that anybody can do it.
How are you going to cover the insurance for that?
Thankfully, through the Colorado Mountain Club, which I'm a member of, you can get very inexpensive insurance. So.
Oh,
well, part of what Courtney's talking about is sort of ties in with what I was saying earlier about doing your homework. You said you need to budget this ahead of time, right? You need to know what your costs are going to be, because that's how you're going to set up your rewards. Because the last thing you want is to run out of money before you've shipped your books, right? So
that helped you printed your books.
Right, yeah. There's, just in the case of books, there's the cost of the editor, the cost of the cover, the cost of your team, right? But then there's the print costs of the books, the copyright registration, shipping costs,
ISBN number,
the cost of your envelopes, right? Your padded mailers, so you need to know what all of that is ahead of time, and like Courtney was saying, put it in a spreadsheet and. And then, based on that information, you can start to set up your levels. I don't know, that was one of the things that I kind of found fun, was sort of trying to figure out, where the sweet spots were. And one of the things that I learned about from the Kickstarter that failed is that you have to keep the focus of the rewards on stuff that people want. Give them as many options as possible to give you money, right? One of the things that you see from ones that fail, from campaigns that fail, are unrealistic reward levels. Here for $30, you get a print book. Right, exactly, right? For $30, they might be willing to pay for a hardcover, if that is going to be one of your options, right? So you need to find ways, and those costs, the cost of the reward levels, have to be comparable to what it would be if they went and bought the book from Amazon or in a bookstore, because the reaction that I heard is that Nobody. People are savvy. They're not stupid. They're going to want value for what they're paying for, in effect, right?
Now, people are willing to pay a mild premium when they know they're going to be getting something first.
When they're getting access, right? When they're getting access to the to us.
So one of the things that we did when we were structuring ours, you have to have enough low levels to get the people in who can't be backing you at a full, I'm going to get a print something, I'm going to get a physical something shipped to me level. So that's where all of our e-rewards came in, where you were getting art. It's a very art-based game. It's very pretty. So we were giving them advanced access to that, which they would then, you know, print out and just look at, show their friends, I'm backing this thing. And then we had the print and play cards, which, good luck with that. It was a very complex game, but if you wanted to, you could. Or you could just study the cards and be ready to play with it because you had not the prototype version, but this is what's going to actually be there. And then we also wanted to have a number of tiers of double and triple the price of the game for people who wanted to really feel like, yes, I'm a really important part of it. And that's where we got into all of the personalization things. And then we had a few that were just totally whacked out. We had no idea whether anybody would be willing to sink that much into a totally new game company. One of the levels was $500, and you not only got the premium version of the game with your picture thrown in anywhere we could think of it. But if you could get to us, we would throw a pizza party for you. And one of my younger son's friends came up with the $500, so when that game arrives, Charlie's going to throw Jordan a pizza party.
I've seen that with gaming Kickstarters as well, where the people who are putting together the role-playing game or the board game are like, well, you know, if you can reach us at New York or at one of the big conventions where we know we'll be, you know, you get an evening with us, either at dinner or we sit down and play a game together, or for some of the role-playing games, even a custom scenario for you and five of your friends that we will play, and then we'll give you the only copy.
Right, and it's an experience thing.
And it's like, and for that it's like $1,000, which is like crazy. But you know, if you're a fan of somebody, how much are you willing to lay down to spend an evening with them over something unique they made for you?
And another thing that I was talking about as far as giving people options is to make sure that your reward levels don't have huge gaps. So like, for example, let's say you've got, you know, you've got a $5 reward level for an ebook, right? And then you've got a $50 reward level for something else with nothing in between.
Right, you need something in that 25 to 30, which is where most people are most willing to pay money.
Yeah, 25 to 30 is kind of the sweet spot. Like up to 50, like beyond $50, unless you're selling something like a Fantasy Flight full board game, you know, you're not going to get your, the number of donations you're going to get there are going to drop off precipitously. So the vast majority of what you're going to get is going to come in that $25 to $40 range. So you need to have as many options as possible in that range to make people want to jump in.
Cool. So do we have any questions from the audience at the moment? We've gone on for a bit here.
What do you guys think of Patreon? Have any of you looked into that or used it?
So Patreon is an interesting new website, which actually I'm supporting some things on, mostly webcomics. The idea is that you pledge that you'll give so much money per either month or thing, and then lots of people get together and basically subscribe to somebody's work. And of course, as the number of people who are willing to give money and the amount of money that's been pledged per month goes up, the quality of what's being produced regularly goes up as well. For instance, well, like I said, a lot of webcomics are starting to do that as a ongoing support thing, where you're saying, like, yeah, I'll give Phil and, well, I'll say Phil and Kaja Foglio because they're upstairs, but, you know, just whoever. The guy who does Dresden Kodak, for instance, is starting one. You know, I'll give you a buck every month, sure. You know, spend more on coffee, whatever. Or the people who do the Fate role-playing game are doing little mini-books every month or two that you can pledge for. It's like, and if you pledge $1 every month, then you get access, or if you pledge $5, you get more earlier or a nicer version or something like that. And you have your hand up in the back?
Yeah, well, can you just put that?
Well, with explaining what Patreon is, yes.
Okay, good. I wanted to ask Susan if she'd please repeat what the number of, for the requests that is most common to get success on your first time around.
Okay, if you are doing a first-time campaign and you don't have backing, you want to probably stay in the 5 to 10,000 range. And you also want to be really, really, really out there for 3 months, minimum, 6 months is even better, where you start telling everybody you know to tell everybody they know that you're going to be doing a Kickstarter, that it's going to be brilliant, that this is what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
And then about a week before you go live, you email everybody you can think of that you've already been telling and say, on this date, at this hour, we are going live within 24 hours. Can you please give us whatever support you're planning on, because we need to start strong.
That's great. The second thing I had, and this is just for the general panel, we found sort of a good percentage of sort of in your budget, how much of the total cost you need do you allot to the Kickstarter fundraise, and how much is from personal and all the other areas. Have you found a sweet spot with that? Do you just ask for the entire amount?
I think it depends on really on how much you need.
You have to ask for the amount of money that you need to complete that project. Because if you ask for less and then you're still left holding a sack, an empty sack that needs $2,000 in it, what are you going
to
do this?
Well, I mean, I'll say grants, that. Like, you have to show how much you're contributing, you have to show other funding sources.
No. What Kickstarter asks you to do is to list strengths and weaknesses of your campaign. So the strengths are everything that the people involved are bringing to it. That I have 30 plus years of publishing experience, that my son just finished art school, and my other son has been working on game development since he was 9, so that's 2/3 of his life now, a little over that. That we already had the prototype out, that we've been playing it, that people liked it, all that sort of thing. And then you want to list in a non-threatening way the potential hazards, okay? That if we get this money, what would keep the project from coming to fulfillment in a timely manner? And, you know, you don't want to say a typhoon hitting Manila. You want to say something that's legitimate, and then say, but this is the step that we are taking to make sure that doesn't happen. And the question about how much you have to ask for, you know, you have to figure out how much you need for the project. I told you before, we need $40,000 to print 10,000 of our second game. We expect to be asking for a Kickstarter of 20, but we hope to be able to find some other way to raise money, possibly through a small business loan, possibly through other means, so that we can limit ourselves to a $10,000 goal, and then if we make 20, we're happy. But we will have some way of covering the rest of what we need.
I think that's a good point, though. I mean, everything I've heard says that set your goal, your initial goal, as low as you possibly can to still cover whatever amount you need. Like, in my case, I'll be honest, like, what I set for my initial goal will probably not be enough to cover my entire cost of printing book. I'm an engineer in my day job. I have a fair amount of money. It's important to me to make this series. So, you know, if it funds, I'm okay with having to pay a little bit out of my pocket to cover the rewards and stuff, because then I'll be able to do a general release of the book on Amazon. I'm about to get my rights back in a few years for these first two. I can, you know, I can make back the rest of that money through direct sales and things like that. But that's the decision that I made, you know, because that was okay for me. But
it's the whole spreadsheet thing. This is a business. You have to have a business plan.
Could I just tag on to that, kind of what you said, which is, so it sounds to me like from your guys' perspective, and I find this as a Kickstarter, like, funder too, it's just it's a place to produce art, but there's not a lot of money in it to say, like if you say, I'm going to pay a cover designer, that's fine, but if you say, I'm going to pay myself, right, you're not, I mean, people don't, like, I know I don't respond to that very well, they're like, I want to pay myself really well to write this book, right, so I'm just wondering what the reality is of how much do you actually put in your pocket for the actual effort that you, the main person behind the Kickstarter, you know, did? And how much is it just a place to get your name out there or your books to people, which is obviously a really valid goal, you know, but I'm just wondering if there's any money on the other side as like the employee of yourself. You did all this work on this Kickstarter. Did you earn anything?
When I set my goals, it's to pay publication costs, cover artists, and to pay the authors. There's nothing, I don't set anything for me to make money. That's for when the book starts selling, that's when I'll make my money. But I set it for just the minimum that I'm going to need to actually get the book out there. And if I make more, great. But it's mostly to get the book out. That's my
goal. I have seen other authors, especially those who are working multiple traditionally published contracts, say that they are asking for enough to make their time worthwhile, to basically do this project sooner rather than later. So that would be people asking for a single novel more in the like 8 to 10K range, and they're literally saying, if I fund this, then that means that I can do the book now, you know, that I can take the time to do it. So people do say things like that, and I know that the band I talked about, the Double Clicks, they got to 80,000 partially because one of them had said, if we make 50,000, then I will quit my job, and I will, you know, and do this, whatever. And people actually responded to that. They were like, oh, this person, you know, they'll be able to make more tours, and, you know, things like that. And so you can state it in a way that people will respond to, but again, you have to think about what's important to you and what the people you're reaching for are going to respond to.
And you have to make the platform. You have to build your audience. One of the reasons that we are at anywhere from 1 to 3 conventions a month is because last year we went from 0 followers on our Kitsune page to about 200 in 2 months, and we're now almost 500, and our Bad Decisions is almost closing in on 140. We only started that in July, and that's the way you do it. We got the advice very early on, how can we promote a game, how can we do it, and I said, you go to conventions and play it with people, because the only way people know a game is to play it. With books, authors have the advantage that people don't actually need to read the whole book, sometimes they'll just like an author enough to try it. But again, you have to be out there, whether it's book signings, whether it's conventions, whether it's writers' groups, libraries, whatever.
All right, well, it's time for us to finish, as the noise from outside intruding says. Thank you to our various panelists for coming in and giving this talk. I hope you all learned something interesting today, and have a good day with the rest of the convention.
Thank you, everyone.
Go. That was the Kickstarter panel from Mile High Con 2014. Yeah, 2014. Not 2015, 2014. Well, I think that's all the content I have in clearance. No, I still have more stuff in clearance that I need to, like, sometimes things are a little late on delivery, but I guess that happens. So, yeah, that's that. If you like us, subscribe, like us, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, everything. Whew! Just go ahead. We love you. If you love us, show it. Go onto there and be like, hey, you know, and tell people about it. And, oh, goodness gracious. Whew, long night. So anyways, I'm your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and you are now caught up.
Control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Detach from station and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really the grave.